Welcome to The Capital Connection, a weekly conversation on New York State government and politics. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for The Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week, as he has many times before, because he's the smartest guy in Albany, is Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York State Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. I hate to say this, but one of the only good government groups that really has been consistently tough, rather than trying to curry favor with some of the legislative and governmental types. Welcome back, Blair Horner.
Thanks for having me. It's always great to be here.
So, Blair, I want to talk to you about the state budget, the big easy or whatever they call it.
The big ugly, I think, is a better way to describe it.
So it comes out, what, some people say $150 million, some people say $155 million.
Billion.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
You are exactly right.
And it's
right.
All our, you know, the people who are listening to this show and the rest of New Yorkers, it's their money.
That's right. So they come up with this money, this thing, and what they don't come up with is any kind of ethics reform in the budget package, which a lot of people had expected. And then maybe I'm crazy.
Did
you want to say something? Maybe I'm crazy. But Andrew Cuomo gives himself a number of opportunities, one with Hillary Clinton, of all people. They hold up their hands and champion in Rocky fashion and say, we achieved a $15 an hour wage in New York. Did they?
Well, it depends where you live and what year you live in it. You know, the budget, I mean, you sort of set it up perfectly. I mean, really, in some ways, was in the ugliest process I've ever seen. I mean, it was really sort of completely shrouded in secrecy. Lawmakers and the governor did almost everything humanly possible to avoid any public scrutiny of what they were doing. And they not only met in secret, they met in the governor's mansion in secret, so nobody could even accidentally see them having discussions. Really was incredibly shrouded in secrecy. The bills were jammed through at the last minute with no real ability for lawmakers to read the bills, much less analyze them.
And they had a message of necessity attached to them.
Well, under New York state law, bills have to sit on the legislators' desks for 3 days. And that's the theory is so that they can actually take a look at the legislation they're voting on. However, the Constitution does allow the governor in times of emergency, you know, like attack from a foreign power or whatever, hurricane or something, for the governor to short-circuit that process and issue what's called a message of necessity, which allows the lawmakers to vote on the bills instantaneously. And that's how they did all these budget bills.
Now, sorry to interrupt, but the message of necessity, as you indicate, is supposed to, I think, if you read the Constitution carefully, be reserved for things like tsunamis,
major earthquakes.
And yet, governors for a long time now have been attaching them, which is the most anti-democratic thing you can think of, small d, because when you do that, as you suggest, you don't give anybody a chance to read it. Now, I believe what the idea, the principle here is get them in the room, as they always have, keep them there all night when they're tired enough and beginning to act like sheep and going, bah. And if anybody dares to say, I want to talk about this, you know, everybody looks at them. Hey, I want to go home. I want to go to sleep. This is terrible. And it isn't improving. It's getting worse.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, it was as bad as anything I've ever seen in the 32 budgets I've watched here. Well, and if anything, it's the worst. You're absolutely right in terms of the message of necessity. In fairness to Governor Cuomo, he uses the message of necessity far less sparingly than most of his recent predecessors. I mean, when Governor Pataki was governor.
You mean far more sparingly? You said less, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Well, if I said that, I meant that.
Well, if I said millions,
sparing.
I meant billions.
Right. Fair enough. Thank you for catching me. Yeah, the governor doesn't use it that much relative to his immediate predecessors. But it's a bad process. In fact, they were even moving bills to the floor with messages where huge sections of the bills were omitted. And when the minority party legislators asked the majority party legislators, well, where are these sections? They said, oh, don't worry, it'll come in the final bill at the end. I've seen that occasionally, but it seemed like a common practice this time around. So it's just a bad process. And one of the issues that the governor had proposed be included in the budget was a package of ethics reforms to react to the unbelievable scandals that have rocked the Capitol. And then he promptly dropped the issue, didn't push it, didn't galvanize the public, didn't do anything. And so not surprising it fell off the table as you, I mean, this is a long-winded response to your original question.
Yeah, but
yeah, the ethics fell off. And so that was that.
The big question with Andrew Cuomo, I'm sorry, Andrew, if you're listening. The big problem with Andrew Cuomo is we never know what he really wants. So he'll say, I want a $15 an hour minimum wage in New York State. And then in some cases, it's 6 years before it kicks in. Well, as his father used to say, Shanash Nunu Babur, between now and then a new pope may be born and things can change. And yet he stands up there with Hillary. They hold their hands up and say, we're declaring victory for $15 an hour. And people are going along with it in record numbers. People are saying, isn't this terrific? We've achieved this.
Again, just to be as fair to the governor. I mean, there's the goal, ultimate goal is $15 an hour. But you're right. In some parts of the state, it may never happen. As I understand it, in upstate regions,
some of it's indexed.
It's indexed. And then the division of the budget will review it after a few years and, depending on the economic environment, decide whether or not it goes forward.
And maybe who's governor.
And that's also possible. I mean, it would be in the next term of the governor, if my mathematics on the years work out. But you're right. It gets phased in. Depending on the region of the state, it gets phased in faster or slower. New York City, faster. Upstate, slower.
Well, New York City is a couple of years.
That's right.
So that's fascinating to me.
But they are claiming victory because the goal, the policy goal is there.
I get it.
But any legislature, you're absolutely right, in the future could change it if they wanted to, but I doubt they would lower the minimum wage.
Well, when one thinks of a governor going around New York State on a victory bus and naming his project after his late father, you would say he wants a $15 an hour minimum wage. Well, you want that $15 an hour minimum wage, it sounds like, now. As a result of the budget, but instead, it's 6 years, it's 4 years, it's indexed, it may happen, it may not. And the lack of the ethics bill, you see, I'm a big Andrew watcher. So I'm interested in the fact that there are many people who think he doesn't really want an ethics bill.
Well, you know, what you see in the budget often is the governor uses the issue of ethics as leverage on other issues that he wants to see in the budget.
So.
Well, so for example, before you said it's not always clear what the governor wants, and that, of course, that's a reasonable argument, but you can tell when he fights hard for an issue, he wants it to get done, no matter how contorted and yoga-like the position is at the end. So it was clear this time around, because he was driving around the state on $15 minimum wage, on paid family leave, that he had to get something in those bills, even if the details are sort of weak. It was clear when he dropped ethics like a hot potato after he announced that he was going to put it in the budget. He made a big speech on it. He never lifted a finger after that. It was pretty clear to lawmakers he didn't want to do it. And maybe, although we don't know because it was all in secret, he might have said, look, I'm not going to push ethics if you guys work with me on 15 in the paid family leave.
Well, you know, Blair.
Because two budgets ago, he dropped the Moreland Commission to get the budget on time. So there is some sort of history of him using his advances on ethics as leverage to get something what he wants in a non-ethics issue at the expense of ethics.
You don't mind if I argue with you a little, do you?
Go right ahead.
Yeah.
People wouldn't understand who it was I was talking to unless you were arguing.
Well, I'm arguing with you in that he dropped the Moreland Commission, you're saying, in order to get other things in the budget. On the other hand, there are those who believe he dropped the Moreland Commission because they were sniffing a little too close to his own issues.
Well, I mean, that's possible, too. But it was in the budget that the governor pulled the plug on the Moreland Commission, and it was in the budget that the governor was getting things that he wanted. So there might have been, there may be more than one reason, I would agree with you on that, but it happened with the deal on the budget. That's when he pulled the plug. And so when he did the redistricting deal, that was the year, that was around the time that the marriage equality passed. And so there are ways, and even gun control issues, so there are ways I think the governor uses policy positions that he knows that the legislature absolutely does not want to do as part of an agreement to get something that he wants in another area.
Blair Horner, there is another context we could look at here, and I do disagree with you on this. You know, the Republicans own the Senate and have for a long time. Both his father and he have decided they're better off, in my opinion, they're better off with a Republican Senate rather than a Democratic Senate because then they'll ask for too much and he'll be the bad guy and all the rest. So he keeps them in office. But he says he's for them. He's endorsed, for example, the guy who may make all the difference in the Dean Skelos seat, the disgraced Dean Skelos seat, a guy named Kaminsky, a federal prosecutor. But as many journalists have pointed out, he hasn't lifted a finger.
That's right.
You know, to help the guy. All that means to me is he doesn't want it. And he doesn't want the Senate to be Democratic. And now the same thing exists in the budget. Let me ask you this. He's a powerful governor. He has tremendous sway. He could go to all kinds of people and say in the Republicans, you want to stay in office. You want to still be the majority and not warm spit being in the minority. You got to do what I say. But he doesn't do it. And in other words, their whole survival is dependent on Andrew Cuomo.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I would necessarily disagree with a lot of what you said. I mean, I don't know what's going on in the mind of Andrew Cuomo, but there's a lot in the budget that helped the Senate Republicans. There is record school aid, which will make their suburban districts happy. There's a tax cut for middle-income New Yorkers, which may take some of the sting out of the vote for the $15 minimum wage. I mean, the Republicans, they have designer districts. The battleground will be Long Island, by and large, and the lower Hudson Valley in terms of whether or not they control the Senate. But upstate, they do have to worry about attacks from the right as well in terms of primaries. And so it's a very delicate line that they have to walk. And so the governor, yeah, I agree, the governor has tremendous sway. This particular governor is extremely skilled at the art of politics, and he gets a lot of what he wants. Now, you know, whether or not he wants a Senate Republican majority or a Senate Democratic majority, I mean, I don't know. The kingmaker in all this stuff in terms of who controls the Senate looks increasingly like it'll be two people, Jeff Klein and Simca Felder, because they may be providing the margin of votes that keep whoever's in the majority.
So let's explain that. Simca Felder runs as a Democrat but votes with the Republicans.
Sits in their conference.
How does he get away with that?
Well, his constituents want him to do that, right? I mean, he runs
well,
as
then why doesn't he be honest and run as Republican?
He runs as a Democrat and a conservative. And so he gets elected. He tells his constituents, I mean, he hasn't been shy about what he's going to do. He says, I'll sit with whoever gives my constituents the best deal. And so he's been sitting with the Senate Republicans. Right now, he's the margin for them in terms of a majority. And he was unhappy, as it's been reported, with the failure of the Senate Republicans to get the education tax credit that he'd like to see to go to non-public schools. And so he may be a kingmaker in all this. I mean, if we talked just before about Kaminsky running against McGrath for Skelos' seat, which is apparently neck and neck. If Kaminsky won that, the Democrats, including Felder, would have a numerical majority in the Senate.
Except for the traitors, the four Democrats who vote with the Republicans.
That's right. There are five in the Independent Democratic Conference. And
that's
Felder.
Two for you, one for me.
And Felder, that's six, right? So they are the kingmakers. So before, when you mentioned how the governor might want a Senate Republican majority, I mean, as a practical matter, he doesn't control where the voters go, but he does have a lot of sway, I think, over those six Senate Democrats and could have an impact even if the Democrats controlled the state Senate.
So let's talk presidential primary. Let me ask you a question. If Bernie Sanders pulls Michigan or Minnesota, whatever, one of those M states, and wins, okay, then what will that do to all of this?
Well, just so your listeners all know, I'm not enrolled in a political party. NYPERG is strictly nonpartisan. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, as far as I know, I'm not a Democratic operative, but it seems like Secretary Clinton's margin right now is really based on superdelegates, not really on the delegates collected in the primaries.
Explain superdelegates.
They are the political establishment of the Democratic Party who will go to the convention and are not elected in the primaries. These superdelegates have been largely committed to Secretary Clinton prior to the primary process starting. I think that a Sanders win in New York, and while he's down by double digits, but it's in the low double digits right now.
In the polls, yeah.
Yeah, in the polls.
Getting closer.
Yeah, I mean, if he wins, that creates a lot of momentum for him. And who knows what those superdelegates would actually do when you get to convention time. So, I mean, there's a lot of delegates in play. It's a close race between the two of them, similarly to what it was with Obama and Clinton 8 years ago. I think the superdelegates are going to make or break whoever wins.
So you are basically the head or the head person for NYPERG, New York Public Interest Research Group, and your members, for a large part, are those who are at colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And they are, when polled, more enthusiastic about Bernie than they are about Hillary. And therefore—
If they're Democrats.
If they're Democrats, right. Yeah. So what are you seeing? I mean, Bernie's honest about this. He says it's all about turnout. But up to now, turnout has not been particularly good among young people.
Well, it almost never is. I mean, I was the first group of 18-year-olds that were allowed to vote. 1972 was the first election where 18-year-olds could vote nationwide. That was my first election where I could vote. Even then, when the Vietnam War was still going on, I mean, it was still only around 50% of 18 to 24-year-olds showed up, 21-year-olds showed up at the polls. So it's always been a low turnout. But in these close elections, it can make a difference. And it can make a difference because the people who do the grunt work in campaigns tend to be young people. Old guys like me, they don't wander around out in the snow and the rain handing out flyers to people's houses or showing up at rallies. It's young people, and young energy can make a big difference. And there is sort of a difference in this sort of, I guess, one recent pollster described it as the Snapchat generation as compared to the millennial generation. They are much more, at least according to polling, much more tolerant and much more in sync with a lot of Sanders' sort of political message. And that may be what is sort of a surprising thing with this. A 73-year-old white male from Vermont captures the hearts of young people across the country, seemingly, or at least the Democratic ones. It's surprising, but it seems to sync up with some of the polling that's been done of the Snapchat generation.
That's very interesting. So in the Republican Party, the establishment, with quotes around it, seems to really not want Trump. And to the effect that even the guy they apparently hate, Cruz, becomes preferable right. to Trump. Frankly, as a political scientist, I can only tell you, I have never really fully understand what that hatred is all about of Trump. Do you have any idea about that?
Well, I mean, he's not beholden to the financial interests that are the underpinning of the financial interests that are the underpinning of the Republican Party. And just so your listeners know, there are financial interests that are the underpinning of the Democratic Party as well. Somebody has to provide the money. And I think the fact that Trump sort of marches to his own tune because he has apparently has the money to do that, I think it scares them because they don't know what he'll do if he became president of the United States. And so, you know, we've had billionaires get elected before, and sometimes they follow an ideological position. Sometimes they don't. Here's a guy who made his money in New York City, who has had sort of, I think you would best describe it as sort of a collage past. There's no linear connection to all of his life experiences, that as far as we can tell. He's been all over the place doing lots of different things. And so, you know, people like to bet on sure things. And the ideological money, the financial interests of the Republican Party don't view them as a sure thing from their perspective.
That's very interesting. That is interesting. So let's then jump to the other guy who people are unsure of, and that's Bernie.
Right.
Now, Bernie obviously does not have the so-called establishment superdelegates you've been talking about. But he does have the young people and some of the women and others who vote in these primaries. You can't walk around New York City without seeing the Trump carousel and the Trump skating rink and the Trump this or that. So this is an election where Trump is doing quite well in New York State.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't appear to be there's really any operation for the other candidates, at least not yet. It may change if Cruz wins big in Wisconsin. Which the polling has him up on, that may change the dynamic for the New York State primary. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like Cruz has much of an operation. And I would assume Trump is going to be very popular. Ironically, just to go back to the special election for this Senator Scalise's seat.
In the state assembly.
Yeah, I mean, there was this concern months ago that the Democrats wouldn't show up because Clinton would be cruising to victory in New York. And that they would lose that special election because Democrats would stay home.
That's wrong.
And it turns out it's the opposite, really.
People come out, they want to be on the winning side.
The one thing that's a little tricky, and again, this is where deeply in the weeds, is for that special election, the polling that's been done is of likely voters. But I'm not sure independent voters know they can vote on April 19th in the special election in that Scalise seat.
That's interesting.
And so you might be polling independents who aren't going to show up, but Democrats will definitely be showing up because it'll be very contested between Sanders and Clinton. And the Republicans may show up because Trump is very popular, particularly in that area. So there's a presidential primary impact beyond the primary in terms of New York State politics.
Want to know what's dumb? I'll tell you what's dumb. New York State, of course, in a self-serving way, has passed a law, unlike Massachusetts or other progressive states where you could take a ballot in either primary.
No, sir.
You cannot do that. Now, you, for example, a really politically knowledgeable guy, cannot vote in either the Democratic or Republican primary because you have to keep your skirts clean, right?
That's right.
You see yourself as an independent. I just think that's wrong, and I think it's so self-serving for the parties that they don't want anybody.
Well, it's
voting.
A very closed process in New York, and if you were registered to vote before the last general election, which was in November 2014, you can't even change your political party to vote in this April 19th primary. So there are many people who may have been. So, for example, in my case, if I was independent, I was all excited about Donald Trump running. I couldn't change my party enrollment after the deadline in last fall in order to vote in this primary.
Yeah,
so it's very, very close. It's airtight.
Yeah,
they just
guys
want their own voters to show up, and that's it.
Right.
These no guys just element of surprise. Like we're talking about the budget process. All locked down. We don't want the public to know what's going on. We want to control everything.
We only got a couple of minutes, but I do want to ask you about SUNY and CUNY. There were tuition hikes that had gotten built in. It was not easy to do it, so that every year there would be a little bit more money charged to students. And students have been described as having a major victory by saying, out with that plan.
That's right.
We don't want that. Can you explain that?
Well, over the Governor Cuomo advanced in 2011 a plan called so-called SUNY 2020 law, which baked in every year annual increases in tuition for both the state university and SUNY university systems. It's about a 30% increase in public college tuition in New York over the last 5 years. And so and that law was expiring this year, and so there needed to be appropriation in the budget or a decision in the budget, what the governor had proposed to extend in the budget for 5 more years, the same law, and it was rejected by both houses of the legislature. So the students like that because here they are paying more every year, and they don't think they should have to pay every year. They think the state should be paying more. The governor's budgets over the last 5 years have effectively been a cut to the public college university systems because he's kept them flat. He didn't adjust it for inflation. He didn't cover basic costs like energy costs or anything like that in his budgets. And so basically the students were paying more and getting more or less the same as what they always got. It was just a shift. So the theory was block tuition hikes, the state would pay more. What has happened is tuition hikes were blocked, but the governor is not willing to pay more. And so
does that mean the governor doesn't particularly care for SUNY and CUNY?
Well, I can't know what's in his mind, but I always know that I always watch what people do, not what they say.
I agree with you.
And in this case, this governor has been much more willing to shift the cost of public colleges to families and reduce it in terms of state revenues. Even though the state had a $1 billion surplus this year, he was not willing to put a penny more into the university systems. And that's going to cause a problem, I think, at both the city university and state universities going forward, is they will be short money because there's no increase in state aid, or if there is, it's very small. Their out-of-state tuition costs can go up, so there'll be some additional money. But so there'll be a little bit more, but it won't be enough to meet the need for this university systems. And so we're going to go back to the drawing board and try to push to get the state to spend more.
I'm interested in this. Chancellor Zimpfer, who I'm very appreciative of, I think she's done a terrific job, has been a very close ally of the governor when he comes along and asks for things. I wonder how she's feeling about all of this.
Well, I think the chancellor, again, I don't speak for her, but I mean, it seems like the chancellor is much more willing to go with the strategy of raising tuition for college students every year by a certain amount because she just didn't believe that they would get the money from the state.
Right.
And the money has to come from somewhere. The university system loses its reputation and its level of expertise. And so we think that the state should just pay more, particularly when the state has the money. It's $156+ billion state budget. And the state can't come up for any more money, any significant money for SUNY and CUNY. That's a big mistake, we think.
We are out of time. Our guest has been the wonderful Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. Blair, I just can't tell you how appreciative we all are about the good work you're doing. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me. It's always great to be here.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.